All right. February, Tuesday, February 25th, 2025. What would that look like? 2-2-5-2-5 or something like that. I don't know. I know people get into these like weird, like numerical things. I will say that I discovered last night that Sylvester Stallone, Sylvester Stone, Sly Stone, was born on March 15th, which is the day after my birthday. So another. Anyway, oh, there's still some people showing up in the waiting room. We're going to meditate for about 20 minutes. And then I have a little reading from Biko Analio, which I think will be one that can stimulate our reflective qualities on practice. So yeah, let's begin with a sit. Just settling into whatever space you're in and seating or lying down or standing or walking, any of the four postures. But and we want to try to come into a comfortable stillness. You can close your eyes or just lower your gaze. And beginning by just being aware of your body and how you're holding it. What it's feeling like right now. We so often sort of don't pay attention to what's going on with our body. So even to take a moment to see how you're feeling can be a good start for a period of meditation or just a moment of mindfulness. What do you notice? Each of us has our subjective experience. Sometimes when I turn my attention to the body, I actually feel something emotional first. Other times, it's hard to even feel the body because my mind is so busy or agitated. And it's also, it can be quite pleasant too when there's not a lot going on, when you can just feel the body breathing and feel yourself sitting, realize there is this capacity to be peaceful. It's with us. Maybe not all the time, but certainly much of the time. And part of our practice is learning to tune into that, to find the stillness, to find the inner peace. There are different ways of understanding our experience, or even interpreting it. There can be an idea that we have to work to develop calm. But there's also the idea that it's actually there all the time, and there's just an overlay of disturbance. So maybe we don't even have to get rid of the disturbance, but learn to become aware of the more subtle stream of calm. Inner stillness. This then means that meditation doesn't have to be such a project where we have to sort through all the five hindrances and develop concentration. Well, this sense of being with our experience and allowing it to be as it is so that there isn't a struggle, even to be okay with the disturbance, with the agitation. Seeing that just as a flow of energies. Not something solid or, heavy that's sitting on our head. Rather something that's moving through the mind, moving through the body, the heart. That non-resistance itself connects directly to the existent peace, the existent stillness. Non-resistance is, in a sense, stillness. No movement. All this becomes too abstract to simply rest with the breath. Feel the in-breath. The out breath. The breath too can be approached in different ways. Can just feel a general sense of the body breathing, the movement rising and falling. Sutta on mindfulness of breathing. Suggest we pay attention to the length of the breath, whether it's long or short. It could also be thought of as the rhythm of the breath. Or we can be more focused on a particular sensations like the air at the nostrils. The movement of the belly, just feeling the diaphragm expanding and contracting. There's no right way to pay attention to the breath, and we can move between different modalities as they feel comfortable. As we're drawn to them, as we very settled to them. The idea is that the breath is always here, so always available, as a tangible sensation associated with it, multiple sensations. And it also exemplifies one of the characteristics of existence, the impermanence with its constant change. What serves many purposes. In fact, the prime purpose is to focus the mind. We aren't much directly trying to focus the mind, but rather by paying attention, the mind becomes focused by paying attention to the breath. There's a natural focusing that can happen. Whatever strategy we're using, the key mental quality is mindfulness. To observe whether we are grasping. If the mind is very busy or distracted, just to see, to come back. Notice any judgments, sense of comparing, measuring, analyzing. Maybe in the simplest sense, mindfulness shows us how we are making a problem out of something that is not an actual problem. Paying attention to the breath, being present. right. Using the baby bell this morning because the big bell is packed up. I thought I would talk or start just by talking a little bit about the idea of a self-retreat. I know some of you do this kind of practice, and some of you have probably never been on a meditation retreat at all. But if you've been on some organized retreats, structured retreats with teachers in a group, and circumstances aren't availing you that possibility, or you just would like to try it, it can be really interesting to just set aside time to do your practice for a certain number of days. And these days I kind of take up the opportunities when my house is empty to do it, but I've also many times gone away to, and there are some centers that have spaces that Vajrapani has cabins you can rent, and then, or you can, I've gotten an Airbnb for a few days. In any case, the idea is really, to structure your own retreat. One of the advantages of it is that it kind of takes off some of the pressure of being on a retreat, like the schedule that you have to follow. Like maybe you're taking a walk, it's like, oh, I've got to get back for the next sit. It's like, no, I can push my sit back. I can sit, and you obviously you have to trust your own discipline. You have to be disciplined to some extent. But if you're a serious practitioner and been on some retreats, it's probably not that difficult for you to do that. And I kind of set up a schedule, but it's not like a tight schedule, but it's just one that I'm work like basically I'm like I want to sit for 6 hours a day at least, and then kind of I like to sit hour long sits because they challenge me a little bit more, but it can be shorter, and at times in the evening I would just do shorter sits. And then there's many times I've listened to Dharma talks. These days I usually prefer to read and kind of use it as an opportunity maybe to study some things that in my daily life are harder to sit down with and really reflect on. But I also like I found that Thich Nhat Hanh has some books that are these almost like children's stories, and they're really pleasant to read. Like if you're not really wanting to read something dense, but you'd like to sort of just relax, sort of reading these Buddhist, I won't, they aren't really children's, some of them are children's stories, but just read these sort of stories. It's a nice kind of other way to work with your energy. And you could do walking meditation, of course. But you often wind up like, okay, you have to cook for yourself, and you might prepare meals beforehand. But I find the cooking and the cleaning and, keeping house to be really good practices. And then the retreat then becomes more integrative, and I start to become more capable of being mindful in my daily life outside of retreat. So, I really highly recommend it. I think that. It particularly, one of the values of this is giving you a sense of your own agency in your practice, not the sense that you depend on this retreat center or this other people ringing bells or anything that like, oh, I can do this. So it actually brings up, and I realized this some years ago, it brings up the hindrance of doubt. Do I trust my own practice? Do I trust my own discipline? Will I just, be a flake and sleep all day or something? It's like, oh, okay, look at that. What do I believe about myself? So, as I said, one of the things I do often is do some reading, and you might imagine that I have a few Buddhist books in my house, and not I haven't read every one of them from front to back, and I have one row of one shelf, bookshelf that's just books by Anālio. So Bhikkhu Anālio, if you don't know him, is a Buddhist scholar who's done a lot of work in the last couple decades translating suttas that were in different languages and then comparing them and sort of trying to figure out like what was the original teaching and what's the really accurate one, and so that it can become quite academic, but he's also a very deep practitioner and also a very practical practitioner. That is, he addresses like what it's some of the challenges, the typical challenges, and he talks about his own, preference, but says like, well, but there's other ways you can do this. And so you have to, when you read him, sometimes you might want to skip over certain sections or sort of get through them to get to something that, because I'll be reading it kind of going, yeah, okay, what, whatever. It's like you're sort of understanding it, but sort of half understand. And then you land on something where it just pops out. So that I want to share with you one of those, and I'll contextualize it a little bit. So this is a book called Abiding in Emptiness, which immediately you think, okay, this will be light reading, right? Not. And it's based on two suttas, the Chula Sunyata Sutta and the Mahasunyata Sutta, which means the shorter discourse on emptiness and the greater discourse on emptiness, and they're in the Majjhima Nikaya. And so I'll give you some of the chapter titles as you're reading through it. So you start out with the sections, really. So there's daily life. Okay, great, we can do that. But and then it, but it's about finding emptiness in daily life. So you're okay. Seclusion, earth. So there's a whole section on earth as a meditation, and this is where it starts to get really, for me, quite challenging. Then infinite space, infinite consciousness, empty of self, signlessness, and nirvana. So I kind of like, I started out reading the daily life part, and then I was like, I kind of want to get like, and so I kind of jumped around. I read some of the earth stuff, and I was like, this is just like, I don't know. I'm not getting it. I'm getting some of it, but so at some point I jumped around to the section on signlessness. So we've already gone through earth and infinite space and infinite consciousness, and again, I'm familiar with these terms, and I'm not going to get into them, but they're particularly infinite space and infinite consciousness are the names of two of the eight jhanas, which are the deep concentration states. So you can see there's like a connection with that. But in any case, we get to this chapter on signlessness. So I'm going to read like a page of it, a little over a page. And some of it refers back to some of those earlier chapters. So I'm just mentioning that. And this section is called The Notion of Signlessness. So if you happen to have this book, Abiding in Emptiness, this is on the section, I guess it's a chapter, Signlessness, that has subheadings. The Notion of Signlessness. The basic sense of the sign, which in Pali and Sanskrit is nimitta, for you, is the characteristic mark of something which enables perception to recognize what that something is. That's not a complicated idea, right? So this term nimitta refers to like, oh, that's how I know that's what it is. Like, I know that's a Ford because it has the Ford logo on it. Or something. I don't know. Silly. Due to its function to cause the arising of a memory or association, the term sign can at times convey a plain causal nuance. Okay, right away I'm like, okay, causal nuance. Like, because, all right, but anyway, oh God. Signlessness in turn is an intentional abstaining from taking up any sign, a deliberate ignoring of the signposts that experience offers for the purposes of recognition and mental association, a refusal to construct meaning out of the available data provided by the senses. That to me is a pretty interesting idea. Okay, apparently this is something the Buddha wants us to do sometimes in our meditation. In fact, this suttas begin with Ananda saying to the Buddha, I think I heard you say that when you meditate, you abide in emptiness, the title of the book, right? The Buddha's like, that's right. And so Ananda's like, could you explain that? So here we're kind of understanding what it means is that somehow you're meditating, but you're not naming or even making any association with anything that's happening. Okay, I'll go on. The sand, because we it actually gets to a point where it's like, oh, okay. Like why I like this. The standard description of signless concentration in the early discourses stipulates two conditions for its attainment: not giving attention to any sign and giving attention to the signless element. Okay, the signless element, here we go. The two conditions mentioned in this way complement each other. Since attention is present in any state of mind, once it does not take up any sign, there is a need to explain what it does instead, which in the present case is giving attention to their absence. Okay, let's go over that briefly. So attention is present in any state of mind, okay? If you're aware, then there's attention. But if you're trying to pay attention, but not pay attention to anything, what you pay attention to is the things that aren't there, the non... Okay, that's the best I can do with that. This appears to be what the signless element stands for. That is, the attention to their absence. The explicit mention of this second condition clarifies that signless concentration differs from the attainment of neither perception nor non-perception. For example, a technical term, another jhana, or else from just being unconscious, right? So signless concentration isn't just being unconscious. The meditative cultivation of signlessness does not issue in a state where the taking up of signs is in principle impossible because perception has become partially or completely dysfunctional. Okay, again, like it's not that complicated an idea, but the words for me are hard to follow. So signlessness doesn't come because your brain is off the rails. Signlessness, the cultivation of signlessness does not come because you just can't pay attention to anything because you're like whacked out, completely dysfunctional. Perception remains fully functional, but is deprived of its usual food, so to say, as the practitioner maintains the conscious resolve not to pick up any sign. So I know some of you have had some deep concentration experiences and deep meditative experiences. So think about when you've been on a retreat and things get very, very quiet and you're not really paying attention to your breath and you're just sitting and you're just sitting and eventually it's just like in Zen, we say thusness or isness, right? It's just this, right? Okay. The type of concentration under discussion here is devoid of a circumscribed object to focus on, thereby partaking the nature of the previous steps. So a circumscribed object to focus on, the breath, you know, a mantra, loving kindness phrases, right? And I don't, he's saying even a circumscribed is sort of unnecessary. It's devoid of an object to focus on, a thing, right? That's why it's empty. As mentioned earlier, cultivating these perceptions requires mindfulness more than concentrated focus. I think this is a very interesting point. Leading the mind into a calm abiding without relying on something to focus on may at first appear challenging for those of us who are accustomed to employing a clearly circumscribed object on which to concentrate. Right? If you're used to, I always do sweeping meditation, or I always pay attention to the breath, or I always note, then for somebody to say, well, stop doing all that stuff. Kind of like, well, what am I supposed to do? You're just leaving me hanging out here. My mind's just going to get lost, right? Which is the risk, frankly. However, the cultivation of concentration, samadhi, or perhaps better, mental composure or collectedness, quotes there, is not confined to such focusing on a circumscribed object. So in a Let me just simplify the sentence. The cultivation of concentration is not confined to focusing on an object. And this is a really important point because many times I think that the way people understand meditation when they're taught, pay attention to your breath, is that concentration is concentrating on my breath. If I'm not concentrating on my breath, I'm not concentrating. I'm doing it wrong. Here we go. It can also take place, concentration, that is, can also take place in a quite different manner, as is the case for the present and the two preceding steps. Okay, here's the wrap up. A particularly helpful indication in this respect can be found in a description of the faculty of samadhi given in some Pali discourses, although this description is not found in the respective parallels. There's the scholarly thing. This definition of the faculty of concentration provides the following indication. So this is from the suttas. Quote, having made letting go the basis, one will gain concentration and will gain unification of the mind. Unquote. The idea of letting go would be particularly pertinent to the present type of samadhi, which requires letting go of all signs. Now, when I got to that, I was like, why didn't you just say that in the first place? It was like you took me through like the infinite consciousness, infinite space, neither, the casinos and all this terminology and you're just now you're just telling me all I have to do is let go. Well, that's my practice. Thank you. Thank you for affirming that what I've been doing all these years and all these days is right. And this is, what's interesting about reading Inalia, like people can get really stuck in his stuff because it's like, okay, what are we referring back to, which sutta and what's the Chinese version of it and what's that Pali term mean? And all of a sudden it's like, oh, you're gonna letting go. And you guys have all practiced letting go. And the more you practice, I realized this some years ago, and the years now have all melted together in my past, so I can't tell you whether it's 10, 20 years, 30 years. But I was like, my practice is really just letting go. Just keep letting go. And you know what? That's one of the first things that I was taught. Because it was Ajahn Chah's main teaching, right? And it was Jack Kornfield passing that on from Ajahn Chah. And then I wrote a song called Ajahn Chah. He told me, you gotta let go. So I just let go. That was 45 years ago. Okay. And it's the same thing, And you get a book, it's like, okay, I'm gonna study about abiding in emptiness. Okay, this is gonna be deep. This is going to be heavy. I've got to go on like a 3-year retreat to get this down. I've got to, get my infinite consciousness running, and I don't forget about neither perception nor non-perception. I have to figure out what that means. Like, no, just fucking let go, Just. And so it's really interesting then, because if you practice letting go in a serious way, and particularly on a retreat, and you keep letting go and keep letting go, you will find yourself abiding in emptiness. You'll be there, and you might not even know that you're there. You probably won't, But afterward, you'll hear a Dharma talk or you read a book, and you go like, "Oh yeah, I think I was hanging out there. Yeah, right. That's right. Yeah." Because it's a natural place. It again, what we get into this thing about, well, I have to do all these practices and develop all these, states, and I got to build it all up. And it's like what I was saying in the guided meditation today. It's actually there. It's that you got a busy mind. And you need to kind of quiet that down a little bit. But also just keep paying attention to letting go and find what shows up there. What's there when you've let go of everything, or a lot of things. So one of the things that I find very, impactful reading Anallio and studying him is that this is a guy who's like taken it a long way scholastically and meditatively. I mean, he's the guy who's, sleeps in a coffin because he's like, want to practice dying. He's a very serious practitioner. But when it comes down to what he's actually saying the practice is, it's all the stuff we've been doing all this time. It's not something new. It's not like, oh wow, oh, Anália's got a new book. I've got to learn how to do this other kind of thing. It's called, what's it called? Oh, mindfulness. Oh, okay. Oh, concentrate. Samadhi doesn't actually require, this deep state of concentration. Just mindfulness and then letting go. Oh, okay. I think I can do it. So, I mean, it's interesting to see where it comes from, that from the texts, and how he builds all this and these different elements. And as I say, I've explored some of these states. I mean, for some years I was working with a jhana teacher and, touching on some of these things, and I have some sense of them, and it's cool. I mean, the realm of infinite space is a great place to hang out. I would spend more time there if I could access it more, but it's it doesn't solve, it doesn't, solve life. It doesn't solve meditation. So, there's a, I find this, I'm sure many of you have had this experience too, this kind of churning as you're doing some study and doing some practice, and maybe on a retreat or you hear a Dharma talk, and there's kind of like this kind of grasping at teachings, or trying to understand some subtle point of Dharma. And then kind of that falling back into, oh, just this, just letting go, signlessness. It sounds so exotic. Yeah, I mean, Ajahn Pasano, because there's in the instructions on, I will finish that sentence about Ajahn Pasano, but in the instruction on mindful breathing, in the final section of that sutta, we arrive at cessation. And cessation, what it says is breathing in, contemplating sensation, breathe cessation, breathing out, contemplating cessation. And that's, I would venture to say, we might need to ask authorities, that this is essentially signlessness. Because, and it's interesting that the way that Ajahn Pasno talks about it in his book Nourishing the Roots is paying attention to what's not there, which is exactly what Anália says the signlessness is. It's the how does he describe it? He says the okay, the signless element, right? Since attention is present in any state of mind, once it does not take up any sign, there is a need to explain what it does instead, which in the present case is giving attention to their absence. And so Ajahn Pasno says, when you get to breathing in, contemplating cessation, you can notice, like, oh, the hindrances aren't here. Breathing out. Oh, right now there isn't, this. And then what's it like when you let go of the breath? What's there? When you're just, it's really turning the attention back on the awareness itself, which is empty, right? And so the attention itself, we could say, we could equate that with the signless element, because there is no sign in the attention. That's a Kevin statement. Don't take that for gospel truth, or maybe I should say for sutta truth. All right, you guys, thank you for your kind attention, and we have some time left for any questions. I see a few people have had to leave. I think they were like, oh, this is too much. I need to go into emptiness. I need some emptiness, please. Some signlessness. I'm just gonna, and how do I do that? Oh, leave the meeting. Now, if we had a leave the meeting in our brains, we could do that with just get right into signlessness. Click. Bill, hi. I saw your little note. Thank you. I'm sorry you're not able to come on the retreat.
Unfortunately, I'm just up to my, whatever. Anyway, I think I've talked to you about this before, which your whole talk today, about getting into these states that I occasionally will get into. I don't know where the hell they come from, but I find myself I'm not actually paying attention to anything, breath, anything. And all of a sudden I just feel like I'm in this intense state of concentration. There's an emptiness there. It's like you were talking about. And then all of a sudden then I find myself aware that I'm aware of this that's going on. And then I'm going, shit, I want to hang here for a while, And then I get this thing. I think you told me one time, you said, that's clinging. You can't hang on to that kind of stuff, but it's open when it's over, it's over. And I go, okay, that's, but it's just a state that may last for a few minutes or whatever. That's about it.
Yeah, these are accessible. These are not like, you don't have to spend 3 years in the mountains of Tibet to get to these states. And yeah, they're subtle, but we can also kind of, I mean, for me, it really is, it's letting go, but there's also this element of, like, we can kind of point our mind or incline our mind to these states once we've accessed them a few times, once we're somewhat familiar with them, and you can point yourself, and you might go there or you might not. It's kind of like, is this a what the way I think of it is, I'm saying to myself, is this available right now for me? And then I'm kind of like, and that space might open up, or it may just be like, donk, no, that's not really available. So it's not unskillful at all. In fact, it's quite skillful to incline the mind to see if, if that's available to try to move into that space. But yes, that inclining, we need to avoid it becoming grasping or chasing after. And so that's a subtle thing. And this is why, as he's saying, mindfulness is the key to this, because you have to be mindful that you're not grasping. And you're also mindful of the state or the non-state. You're mindful of that. And you're mindful of, letting go, which I think is just an interesting, term in itself. Like, what does that mean to like tune in? Like, what am I holding on to? And how am I holding on to it? How is that holding on happening? And how do I let go? These are all like the subtle questions of meditation. And you can kind of just drop those questions in, like, where is there that? What am I hanging on to right now? I had a moment, couple days, might have been on Sunday morning, when I felt this pit in my chest. And it was like that, oh God. And I made a shift in perception where I opened up and kind of channeled energy through my body. And again, these things are hard, they're hard to describe, but it was just like, oh, just like whoosh, let that. And it wasn't pushing the feeling away. It was just making space so that that wasn't the whole, wasn't like grasping my mind into this, like, oh, this is bad mood. Because sometimes, as I talk about a lot here, I will turn my attention to that feeling and breathe with that feeling and see if I can just let it be there without fighting it. But it felt like, and I wasn't really doing that it was more like I was stuck there. And I just thought, well, is there an alternative? Like, there's more to my mind than just, and the more to my experience in this moment than just this heaviness in my chest. There's actually my whole body and my whole mind. And let me just open that up and see what happens. And it really, it like, just shift. There was a huge shift. It was really interesting. So, I mean, that's just another example of the subtle ways that we apply mindfulness to our experience, and we just kind of dance around and experiment. Like, what's happening, and what's a way to respond to this? Do I need to go in closer? Do I need to step back further? Is there something I need to let go of? Do I need to focus on an object? Do I need more attention? And there isn't one way to do any of this. It's a dance, and this is why retreats are really valuable, and why daily meditation is valuable, because it's not one thing that you're learning to do. You're learning a whole raft of skills that you try to organically learn to apply. And a lot of times that's trial and error in any given moment. And that's becoming a skilled meditator. Becoming a skilled meditator isn't getting really good at concentrating, which I think most people think that's, oh, that's, you get really good at meditating when you can really quiet your mind down and just sit. Like, that's not. No, that's just being good at concentrating. Being a skilled meditator is being able to face the array of experiences and have an array of tools for engaging them and playing with them. And so it's the art, it's that art of practice. So that was more than anybody asked for. And during that time, I see Debbie gave up. So I'm calling on you now, Debbie.
So,
Your arm got tired from holding it up for that long.
no, I was getting, my mind was starting to go everywhere. I mean, this is such a, thank you for this session today. It's such a huge realm. And, I really look forward to reading the book, Abiding in Emptiness. It's
Good
like,
luck.
I know, really. But it's like the word, we need the words because they're what there's they are what they're the pointers, right?
Yeah.
And yet then we find this actual experience is wordless, it's nameless, it's an embodiment kind of
Yeah.
thing.
Yeah.
And I have found that often when I've landed there, and it seems like the doorway or the journey is, breathing in with awareness and then this breathing out, releasing, and it doesn't matter what's coming through my stream of consciousness or body or sensations, it's this role of breathing in and recognizing and breathing out and letting go. And then at some point I'll end up in, I can become aware that I've been in that place when I return at, when I'm coming out of it. It's like awareness of the awareness. It's like, is this, so is in that moment, is awareness an object? Because when I recognize, oh my, whew, and there's not a word to go with it, but the relationship with life is different. It's something that's not explainable, right? And so I feel like the beauty of it is when I'm not striving, when I just rest in the practice of releasing, of receiving and releasing until I'm not attaching to whatever's coming through the sense doors, until it's just this spacious flow. And then all of a sudden it's like I'm dissolved into it all. It's a selfless thing. It's a unification kind of thing. And it's like I can't conjure it up, but when it happens, it's such a gift. But my question to you is, when I'm coming out, and there's this mental, recognition, oh my gosh, there I was. Is that, in that moment, is awareness a mental object? Is that an object? Does
I don't have
that
an answer to that.
I was just curious.
I know, and I think every all the different Buddhist traditions have different ways of even talking about these things, right? You have the Tibetans with these kind of exotic sometimes imagery with it. You have Zen that's like very cut and dried, and then you have these Theravadins who are like taking it apart, piece by piece and trying to put it back together. And all of it is trying to understand, put words on the, as you're saying, the wordless, and some teachers or teachings will give more meaning to this, and others will point more to like non-attachment. What I'm more interested in, rather than defining what's happening, is understanding what the value of this is, and what how it applies in terms of insight, right? To me, this then comes back to perception. That is how I understand reality, and how I interpret reality through my memory and my conditioning. And that's what I think that this practice is really about, because the whole idea that about the sign is about perception, okay? And we all interpret our experience in different ways. And how we interpret our experience then has a huge impact on how we feel, on how we think, and how we act in the world, and how we interact in the world. And so perception is it's so important to keep an eye on perception and be careful about it, and remember that it's conditioned, that it's not reality, it's not truth, it's your own understanding or interpretation of reality right now, and you might be wrong. So keep an eye on that. So that to me is more important than like what is this state and how do I understand it from a meditative standpoint, but rather why I think the Buddha wants to hang out there and do that is that like perception is where all the problems of the world are created. And when I can stop being engaged in naming and trying to create and interpret and figure out reality, then there's this great freedom that comes from that. So that's why it's a pleasant place to hang out, But then secondarily, and in practical terms, knowing that all the problems of the world come through my perception, and my which is another word for perception is belief, then which is also views and opinions, right? So and knowing that and keeping an eye on that, I think is the insight part of this that's so important. Like, just keep an eye, keep your mindfulness applied to how you are interpreting what you're experiencing and what you're believing about it. So.
Yeah, and I just want to add, sometimes that might, all I know is when I come out of this particular experience, I move differently in the world.
Yeah,
I'm
right.
softer.
Yeah.
I'm more present. I'm
Yeah.
more courageous. And so for me, I feel like it's supporting this thing, this organism, to contribute to compassion and kindness and wellness in the world. And if that's what it does, I'm in.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's the transformative aspect of it. That's beautiful. Thank you. You know, Monica, I'm going to come to you, but I saw Erin like waving her hand. Like, it feels like maybe there's something more urgent she needs to say.
I was actually raising my hand for her, but
Oh.
she's figured it out now, so I'm gonna
Oh,
hop
okay.
off.
I
But
see. Okay.
thank you so much, and
Oh
for
my
the
gosh.
talk. So it's Aaron's on the.
Take it away, Erin.
Yeah,
I want you to know
I'm
you
gonna.
are on the spot, and we are all judging you right now. So just in case.
Oh
Yeah.
well, just know I'm as close to perfection as you can be.
Excellent, excellent.
Excellent. Now I forgot. I couldn't figure out that freaking hand thing.
I
Anyway,
know.
Kevin, I've been listening to your podcasts and following you today. Okay, itty bitty bit of background. I live in Colorado, which is in Denver in particular, which is a super liberal state, you may or may not know.
Yeah.
So I'm free to talk about my beliefs with anyone. Here in Arizona, where I stay for the winter, what you just said, I've learned in my meditations, which is I can't judge everyone. They might be a different whatever. And my belief in the color orange. But if I continue with those perceptions, I am not going to have any female friends here. So I've had to start thinking of them of that word as adjectives and not as nouns. You know, that's not the whole person, that's just a little bit. But what I was going to say before you said what you said was, I was in a meeting this morning in here, and to my complete shock, the chair said she had just read something in, I think it was the 12-step workbook or something like that, that Buddhist word, she said the word Buddhist. And this is a place where the only God people talk about is Jesus and Christ and all that. And I know for a fact she's an atheist because she told me, but this speaks to her. Buddhism speaks to her. And so I just really just have a question. So everyone's sitting there, you know, duh. And I've had conversations with people around here. Well, I pray on that, and I pray, and I pray. Do you ever meditate? Well, that's kind of meditation, isn't it? I'm like, I don't know. Do you get still?
Could
And
be.
really, the way they're talking about it, no, it's more talking out loud to God. So do, okay, this is a simple question. Do Buddhists pray?
I think the simple answer is yes, but it's there's two elements that are distinct about that. One is Buddhists aren't praying to God or to anyone else, and so that, so that's the first part. And so the form of prayer looks different. So because I consider loving kindness meditation to essentially be a prayer, because you're sitting there and you're saying, may I be happy, may I be peaceful, may I be safe. So there's a wish involved in it, because prayers seem to involve some kind of wish, and there's words, and it's not just paying attention to the breath. It's so, meditation and prayer, I think they bleed together, because how we in contemporary Buddhism define meditation is as kind of the combination of mindfulness and concentration, and that it's not really aimed at any, it's sort of aiming at signlessness in a way. It's aiming, not aiming at any particular result, that we're tr that really what its purpose is to put the mind in a particular state of calm and awareness. If that makes sense, right? That's kind of what we try to do with our meditation. But that's a very narrow, well, not narrow, but it's not the whole of what meditation is, which is why loving kindness meditation, well, we can say that that's trying to bring calm and put us into a state of love, but it's also doing other things, right? It's trying to foster us an attitude toward the world. It's trying to help us to have insight about suffering. It is trying to generate something positive into the world, to send something positive out into the world with the hope that maybe consciousness has an impact on others, but at least it's generating something within me. So you can see that, because when you say a prayer, I mean the Serenity Prayer, God grant me the acceptance to
The serenity. The
accept the things I
serenity to accept.
cannot change. What did I say? I don't know. The serenity to accept the things I cannot change. Well, I'm trying to bring about a certain result, but actually in the prayer itself, it's not so much that I'm wanting that to happen in the future. By saying, so reminding myself that, I'm fighting right now to make something happen, it helps me to let go, right? I mean, the Serenity Prayer is about, it's about right effort. It's about letting go of the unwholesome, and it's about cultivating the wholesome, the courage to change the things I can. So it's all wrapped up right away in it has a meditative component. So, but nonetheless, I think the simple question you're asking about, if somebody is just, saying their Hail Mary or something and then going along with their day, they're probably not cultivating the mind states of calm and clarity that are so valuable, and they're missing out on really developing that, because those mind states, are the way to freedom. That's the end of suffering. That's how we end dukkha. It's by letting go, right? We realize when we start to practice meditation that it actually takes training and time and work to cultivate this capacity. It's not enough to just say, God, may I have calm and clarity. Okay, see you later. I have to actually work at training the brain and the mind and the nervous system to respond in this way. And that's what people really miss out on in AA, and why I wrote One Breath at a Time, so that people would start to do that.
Great, thank you. Could I just follow up? So I
Sure.
spent 2.5 weeks
Meditating on radical forgiveness. So it sounds like what you're saying is, I was praying. Do I have that right? Kind of. I mean, I was in a deep kind of.
No, I think you're cultivating a certain mind state, so it's meditative in that way. As I say, I mean, we can say that, maybe there are polarities over here. There's like this, God save me thing that's like not related to meditation. And over here, there's like the signless meditation. But when you start to come closer, if you're reflecting on forgiveness, you're doing loving kindness, you're chanting the refuges, the components really start to blend together. So there stops being a really clear distinction.
Okay, so I can tell these people I'm praying too. Yeah.
Yes, you can. Absolutely.
So they leave me the hell
Oh
alone.
yeah, it's none of their fucking business anyway. Just tell them you're praying. You can lie. It's right speech, and that I'm giving you
Thank you,
my
Kevin.
blessing to fib.
You're awesome.
Thanks, Aaron. All right, you guys. Well, we're off. We have to finish cleaning the house so that the family that comes home tomorrow will come home to a nice house. And then we're off to the retreat, and I'll tell you all about it, or maybe not. You never know what I'll do next week. I don't like to make promises about the future. So I hope everyone is well. Don't drink or use no matter what. Continue to meditate every day, and to try to not be overwhelmed by the world, which is trying to overwhelm you. Blessings.
Namaste.
Peace.
Thanks, Kevin. Thank
Okay.
you. Thank you, Kevin.
All right.
Thanks,
Bye
Kevin.
bye. Thanks for hanging out, you guys. The hardcore.
Thanks, Kevin.
Bye.
Have a good retreat.
Thank you.
You too.